Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get our podcasts. We appreciate it. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'ma think that you are a hater. Coming up, Odell Beckham thinking that the truth justifies talking. That's weird. Is Texas back? We got a AMA, Ask Me Anything from the listeners, but first. Hey, man, your boy Khabib Nurmagomedov went ham. We've been talking about this story long enough that I can pronounce Nurmagomedov without having to look up how to pronounce Nurmagomedov. I've been practicing. Anyway, I don't really do that MMA thing. No disrespect to those of y'all who do. It's just not really my bag. A lot of y'all are really into it. And the people that were into it said going into the fight, like, yo, Khabib Nurmagomedov is going to wax Conor McGregor. Like, this didn't really seem like a fight to a lot of people that Conor had a chance to win. Apparently, going into the fight, Nurmagomedov had not lost a round. Not a single solitary round. That seems pretty impressive. Anyway, he got out there, man. He gave Conor the beats. Like, a couple of the punches that McGregor took. I'm like, yo, they let you keep fighting after you get hit like that? And, you know, took him out, got him on the ground, put him in that that rear naked chokehold, did that to him, kind of tapped out. And then after kind of tapped out, you know, that's when things got a little bit crazy. B jumped over the whatchamacallit, the cage, to go fight one of Conor's people. What else we have there? Oh, yeah. Then Khabib's people got into the ring. Conor took a swing at one of them. So, you know, they was in there playing the feud again. That's kind of a big thing. People don't really appreciate it when that sort of thing happens. Gabe, I did not see this until actually right when I sat down here. But apparently one of Conor's friends, the one that Khabib went after, called him a bleeping Muslim rat.
Oh, man.
And that is what made him jump over the fence.
Yeah, and I saw like 12 different angles from all like areas of the crowd as far as who hit who first, who jumped over what first.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute melee, man.
I gotta say, I've been Team Khabib on this one from the very beginning. Now, and understand this, being Team Khabib on this is also with an understanding that you can't go into the crowd, right? You can't do that. Why can't you do that? 'Cause you can't. So I understand any sort of punishment that is then leveled against Khabib because you cannot jump into the crowd. I get that. It makes things very unsafe. It makes things very unwieldy. But I do have to say, Gabe, that seeing what happened when Khabib jumped in the crowd like that gave me a whole new respect for the fans at the Malice at the Palace because they was actually trying to fight.
Please tell me that you saw the meme that was circulating or like the face swap that was circulating on social over the weekend with Drake being in like the front row. Did you see that?
I did not, but I did see that. Wasn't Drake in the locker room with McGregor holding up the Irish flag?
Yeah, I mean,
what are you doing?
Swap out that flag with just about any other flag wherever he goes, or swap out that with like a jersey of the local team or a hoodie. I mean, Drake did a concert at the college that I was going to and was wearing a hoodie of that college.
Yes.
So that just goes to show, you know, what type of character he is. But the meme that was circulating was like someone's face in the front row that was like totally shocked, but then they swapped it so that it was Drake. And it was basically like Drake's face when like Khabib's, you know, coming over the cage.
Yeah.
And, oh my God.
Look, man.
So good.
Look, man. Them people at the Palace is ready to fight. Them people in Vegas was like, "Ruh-roh, I don't want any parts of this."
Like, this just got real.
Yeah.
Lions are loose at the zoo type stuff.
Yeah, no. Polite was gone, right? There was no more polite in that situation. You are right. Reality had jumped up in the spot. Man, you got me thinking this about Drake. After everything that Conor had done going in this fight and all the stuff that Conor had done before, how you gonna stand there holding that man's flag, standing behind him? Like, how you gonna do that? Seriously, man. Like, what are you talking about?
And holding it too, like he just got done winning an Olympic sprint.
Yes, you can't do that. Like,
for Ireland.
What are you doing, man? I can't believe he let. Actually, I can. But anyway, yo, B went over there to get that dude. And dude, this is the thing. And I don't understand why it is that people of privilege don't realize that the things you say can get you jacked up, right? Like, I mean, the idea that Habib was wrong. Now, whether or not you can jump into the crowd to me is a separate discussion from whether or not he was wrong, right? Like, being wrong is a different thing. I don't know why it is that people believe that you're just going to get out here and say whatever it is that you want to people and that they not going to come run up on you. Because one thing that people of privilege need to understand about people who don't have it, regardless of the circumstance or situation, is respect is all they got to hold on to. Like, in the end, respect sometimes is all you have to hold on to. And when your respect is not given, sometimes you got to go over there and take it because you just not going to tolerate this. So when you get cats like McGregor and his crew and they have been emboldened and empowered to just say whatever it is they want to you, they going to keep doing it. They going to keep doing it. They going to keep doing it. And politely asking them to stop isn't going to work. Now, I saw that during the fight, at one point, McGregor got in Habib's ear and was like, it's just business. No, partner. It was just business for you. Your business is disrespectful to me. And he caught, like, that looked like, you ever read the stories, Gabe, about the Floyd Patterson fight with Ali?
I haven't, no.
The infamous What's My Name fight. So, I forget what name it was. Oh, Ali started calling Patterson the little rabbit. Or some kind of rabbit in that fight. And so Patterson has said in interviews that since Ali was calling him a rabbit, that he would call Ali Cassius Clay. Since you're not calling me by my name, I won't call you by yours. Because, of course, Gabe, calling him the rabbit is the exact same thing as calling him Cassius Clay. Right? Totally the same thing. Ali beat him savagely, beat him cruelly while consistently screaming to him, what's my name? He caught a what's my name beaten. Ernie Terrell caught a what's my name beaten for referring to Ali as Cassius Clay. Like, these are the beatings that you get when somebody feels disrespected.
He could have just responded and said, like, mama call him Clay?
Yeah. And guess what? Same thing would have happened. Like, I don't think that man understood that for Ali, this was not funny. This was not a laughing matter. And so cats like McGregor are of the belief that they can get out there and they can say that stuff because, hey, man, what's the big deal? It's just jokes, right? Like, that's all it is. It's just jokes. We just out here trying to sell this fight. That's all we're trying to do. No, man, that man went out there and beat him. Like, that was not about money. That was not about no UFC. That wasn't about Dana White. He put that on him for his family and the Shaolin Temple. Enough was enough. That was it. And the whole crew apparently had enough. And now you got a guy outside the ring go call the dude an effing Muslim rat? What? And there's only one reason why that dude did that. Because there was a cage in between him and Habib. And Habib needed him to understand. Oh, this cage? It's convertible. It ain't got no roof. I'll be there in just a minute.
Yeah, this ain't Twitter, man.
No, man.
You can't just throw grenades and expect, you know, no kind of response.
Mm-mm. He went and got it, right? Like, that's all this is. So, like, I really wonder about this. Like, I feel like you wind up with these stories about Jackie Robinson. Because, like, and this, I'm not saying Habib is Jackie Robinson, but you'll understand where I'm going here. Jackie Robinson had 2 years where he couldn't fight. And after that, he was fighting all the time, right? And so if these cats knew that Jackie Robinson couldn't fight, they was going to try it. They was going to go for it at every turn. And what we do in retrospect when we talk about Jackie Robinson is we heap all this praise upon him for his willingness to not fight these people. And I do think that there is a certain dignity in the idea that he did not fight those people. It is fairly impressive that he was able to maintain his composure in that situation. However, if you ask me, what would I have more respect for, Jackie Robinson taking it or Jackie Robinson giving it, I'd go with giving it every single time, man. Because people do not have the right to just say whatever they want to you. They don't. And if the UFC wasn't going to stop Conor and his people from doing that, Habib was going to be the cat to do it. Hey, man, listen to him right here. He raises a good question.
I want to say sorry to Athletic Commission, Nevada, sorry to Vegas. I know this is not my best side. You know, this is not my best side. You know, I'm human being and I don't understand how people can talk about I jump on the cage. You know, what about he talk about my religion? He talk about my country. He talk about my father. He come to Brooklyn and he broke bus. He almost killed a couple people. What about this? What about this shit? Why people talk about I jump over the cage? Why people still talk about this?
Yeah, man. He's right. Like when Connor was saying that wild stuff in the press conference, we're like, wow, this is wild stuff Connor is saying. Isn't it funny? It was one dude who was not laughing. It was Cauliflower Nurmagomedov. He was not here for it that whole time. McGregor was trying to talk about, you know, do you want some whiskey? My man's like, yo, don't get down like this. The whole turn, his whole thing is, I don't get down like this. And the joke stopped. And when the joke stopped, oh boy, the beatdown commenced. The beatdown commenced. The beatdown commenced. And as we said, nobody in the crowd wanted any parts of it. Dana White getting on the air. Because see, here's the thing, man. Habib was not fighting a customer per se because it's one of McGregor's people, but you can't be out there running the UFC saying it's okay to jump in the crowd and get to like scrapping out amongst the customers. You cannot do this. I don't know if you ever read the oral history that Jim Miller wrote on ESPN, and I feel fairly comfortable talking about this because everybody, their mama from ESPN talked for the book. But with the Malice at the Palace, if you ever remember that, the night of the fight, the tenor on air was decidedly pro player because the broadcast was largely players. It was very much these fans are tripping, and sometimes you just get tired of all the things that you hear from these people, and you got to go out there and scrap it out with them. Like, it was pro player. Man, they went to sleep, and some phone calls were made, and the network made the decision that we as a company are not about to be out here blaming the customers for getting beat up. Like, this is Mark Shapiro explicitly says this in that book, right? Like, I'm not talking out of turn here. That was the man that was in charge of all that stuff. They explicitly were like, yo, we're not about to be out here saying it's okay to beat up the customers. And so that whole thing turned. Dana White wasn't going to be out here talking about it's okay to jump up amongst the customers and start fighting. He can't have that, right? Like, that is not what you can put out there publicly. It can't be that. Man, Dana White back at the crib jumping in gold coins like Scrooge McDuck. Like he put on his super serious face. This is really bad. This is as bad as it gets. Like, it's not going to be any worse than this. It's really, really, really bad. Yeah, it's terrible. It's super duper bad. Yeah, it's real bad. It's real bad. Man, they counting all the money. They're going to have a rematch of this. Connor says he wants a rematch. And honestly, that's the most shocking development out of this whole thing. Why in the world would Connor want to go fight that man again?
Yeah, he's like, I'm ready to go again.
No.
I'm ready to get knocked out again.
Right. Why would you want to do that? Let me tell you, I bet Habib can't wait for that rematch. He can't wait for that. That's like the best news that he has gotten all day long. Connor going to go out there and catch that L again. I'm sorry. I don't know what kind of money Connor was getting for that fight, but it would not be worth it for that beatdown that I saw him take. And one of them punches he took to the face, I'm like, oh no, I tap out right there. Like, well, I got to wait till you start choking me. No. I don't want to fight anymore. Can we go back to the part where we just sitting at tables and I'd be popping off at you? Like, I enjoyed that a lot more than getting beat up. That would be my outlook on the whole situation. But I have to say this, though. None of this makes me want to actually, like, pay for the fight, though.
I mean, you don't have to pay for the fight. We're not, like, shilling for UFC here. You don't have to pay for the fight. You can just watch the highlights.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, but just generally, I don't. None of this is making me want to watch if they want to have another fight. Like, none of this is making me interested in that way. It makes the UFC certainly more visible, and it gets us talking about it, even coming off a football weekend. But I don't feel like it, like, makes me want to watch the UFC. I think it'll galvanize, like, the within UFC people, and they'll be on this. And then, hey, man, I've said this for a long time, man. I've said this many, many times. When it comes to boxing and all fighting sports, people's desire to watch and their rooting interests are very heavily fueled by ethnicity. I think that we are very fortunate that our friend Habib is not from, say, Mexico, or an African American from the United States. Basically, any ethnic group that could perhaps wind up watching this fight with white people, and then it all get ugly because the scrap then breaks out. I'm very glad that is not what is going to result here. Like, can you imagine? I know they're different weight classes. If that was like John Bones Jones and something like this had happened, Can you imagine what the discussion of this would be?
Oh, man.
Yeah, it just so happened to have Habib from somewhere else, right? So it's like, okay, cool. But, there was a whole lot of people jumping on Team Connor for this one. And I'm like, I don't even understand how Team Connor is a thing at this point. Like, I find him to be really entertaining, but I can't be on the squad. It can't be that. Oh, no. Like, can you imagine that? Where is Habib's from, what, Dagestan?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly.
I think he's even from Dagestan or Kazakhstan. I'm not going to lie to you. I didn't know Dagestan existed until yesterday. But he's from one of them places. Like, if there's a bar that is a Dagestani bar, I don't think you need to run up in there rooting for no Connor. And I don't think you need to be coming up in no Irish bar rooting for no Habib. No, don't recommend it. Don't think that will go well at all. I also have this question. I think this is a fair question to ask. How you think Habib feels or would feel? I'm assuming that there's been some conversation between him and Dana White. And I wouldn't be surprised if there was a conversation before the fight itself about the way that Connor was handling this press stuff with Dana White. Gabe, do you remember what Dana White spent some of his summer doing in 2016?
Repairing McGregor's image?
He was repairing McGregor's image, but he also was involved in politics. He had a candidate that he was with. He endorsed that candidate. And, by the way, he stood at the Republican National Convention and declared his support for that candidate. That candidate, at that time, had a campaign largely fueled by, I think we could safely term it, negative rhetoric against Muslims. You think I'd be trying to hear anything Dana White got to say about this?
No.
Like, hey, this is not me talking politics. This is me talking about life. Like, this is the way things go. This is what it is. You think you're trying to hear any of that noise? I don't know what Dana White did or didn't have to say to him about that, but I would be shocked if Nurmagomedov was able to separate those two things when he went to go fight somebody who called him an effing Muslim rat and all he's being told is how he's wrong. Nah, he did something he wasn't supposed to do. Sometimes that's right. All right, we'll be back in a minute to talk about Odell Beckham. But first, you know what's not smart? Job sites that overwhelm you with tons of the wrong resumes. But you know what is smart? ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't wait for candidates to find you. ZipRecruiter finds them for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills, education, and experience for your job, and actively invites them to apply. So you get qualified candidates fast. No more sorting through the wrong resumes. No more waiting for the right candidate to apply. It's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S., and that rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. Right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BOMANI. ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Oh, man. Speaking of things that you probably shouldn't do, Odell Beckham decided to schedule an interview with our Josina Anderson of ESPN, and he brought Lil Wayne with him. I haven't talked to Josina about this. Maybe I should, but was Lil Wayne just like in the hallway hanging out and they brought him in? Or was that always the plan?
Well, he was in town promoting his album.
Right. But this is my thing. I understand like that level of connection. What I'm saying is like when this interview was it pitched as, yo, you and Lil Wayne, how about it? Or was it you? And then he's like, hey, Weezy with me. Can he come sit in? He got an album coming out. Because it ain't like he said anything, right? Did he? No, that does not appear to be the case. And we once had Lil Wayne come in the studio in Miami to do See or Know with us. And I'm here to tell you, brother, Lil Wayne does not spend his day to day prepared to answer questions that he did not know were coming in advance. He was high. Good gracious, he was high. So, you ain't expecting to get a whole lot much. You're not going to crack into the soul of Lil Wayne in that interview. That's what I'm saying. I didn't know. Maybe they were just hanging out that day. I'm not sure. But the interesting part of this story to me is that Odell scheduled this interview separate from the Giants. Like, this was not through the PR team. This was him sitting there by himself with Lil Wayne, who, by the way, is 36 years old. Not sure if you guys knew that. You probably did, but just let that really sink in. That dude is on the Super Forever Young program. Not like he looks youthful. He just looks young, if that makes sense. Anyway, so Odell sat down, and I remember once when I was younger, I read the interview much later, but I remember my sister was talking about this when it happened, where Rolling Stone did an interview with Whitney Houston. Rest in peace. And they got talking to Whitney Houston, and it seemed very clear that after a point, the interviewer realized, yo, I can get her to say anything, and then just started throwing questions out there. And that happens for you sometimes when you're doing interviews. My man Q, Q in L.A. now, but he was in Denver at the time. He once caught Terrence Howard on one of those days. This is about 10, 12 years ago. And Terrence Howard just started wilding, man, just started saying any old thing in the interview. Like, when you get that person that you know you can get to say anything, you just start seeing what's going to happen here. And so a lot of times with cats like Odell, you got to dance around what the question is. You know, if you got a problem with the quarterback, you got to figure a way to ease it in. Now, apparently Odell showed up with the purpose and the desire to talk about all of these things. It was so millennial, by the way. And I don't even necessarily mean that as an insult. I just mean that in the sense of it felt very much about feelings, right? It felt very much with this idea that I feel it, so it's okay to say it, or I should say it. And, you know, there's pros and cons when it comes to all of that. But it felt a little different than the athlete interviews that we're accustomed to. Like, this new generation, man, they here now. Odell Beckham, I think, is like 26 now. Like, you know, they're not kids anymore. Like, this is it. They're here. And he did a super grown up thing and went around his team and did this interview. And well, here's Odell just talking about if he's really getting what he wants to get out of this playing for the Giants thing.
I just want to be able to be the very best that I can, and I don't feel like I'm given an opportunity to be the very best that I can, to bring that every single day, and that's really all I want to do, is bring that every single day. I don't want to be held back anymore, and since I've been here, yeah, I've put up numbers and records have been broken and all those good things, which, not to say mean nothing to me, but I know that they could have been double or triple, whatever they are now. That's the part that bothers me. I want to win. I want to be great at what I do. I feel like I can score a touchdown in the first half, touchdown in the second half. Honestly, I feel like I can score every quarter if I'm given a chance, but it's not the case. So I said, oh, my God, I need to get 2 touchdowns a game. 100 yards is a minimum. Like, my goals are set very, very high. And if I don't get to help attribute to a team's win or do anything like that, I'm not going to be okay with it, money or no money. Like, I'm just not going to be okay with that.
Yo, man, why they play that Unsolved Mystery music back there?
Because he's mysterious, man.
Yeah, I guess so. Like, we on the trail of the assassins with that music that was playing in the background. Now, I don't think that anything he said there was wrong. I don't think that anything he said there was really improper. And I feel like he said things you want to hear guys say. Like, a dude like that, you worry about complacency, right? No, man, that dude's like, I am trying to be the absolute best, and I think that I can do even more than I am doing right now. But see, it's a matter of phrasing and when you say that, right? You say, I want to be put in a position to do more to help this team, right? I think I can score a touchdown every half to help this team. You put everything in that context and say all the same stuff that he said right there, and there's honestly nothing to it, right? But when you're like, I could put up 100 yards. I could do this. And to be fair, he did say in there that he wants to help this team win, but I think you understand what I'm saying, like the subtle difference there in how that can be phrased and it not really so much be a thing. That's how. It's like, look, I feel like I can help this team. Now, I also know this. It is very difficult to find a way to say, I think the best way for this team to win is to give me the ball all the time. Right? It's hard to say that even if it's true and people not only hear and have people not hear simply the fact that you want the ball. Because I think we'd agree, right, that the Giants would probably be best if they gave the ball to Odell all the time. And, well, we'll get to this part in a second, because I just want to tell you more that Odell had to say. And this part here is about the quarterback.
I don't know. Like I said, I feel like he's not going to get out the pocket. He's not. We know Eli's not running. But is it a matter of time issue? Can he still throw it? Yeah, and it's been, you know, cool catching a shallow and trying to take it to the house. But I want to go over the top of somebody.
Now, that is interesting. By the way, you hear the uh-huh from Lil Wayne?
That was his contribution.
Yes, that's what he had to say. Lil Wayne, he's like, can he like it out the pocket? You know he's like, get out the pocket, huh? Like Lil Wayne couldn't help himself.
He's kind of the hype man there. Like, yeah, yeah, what he said.
Yeah, he couldn't help himself. He could not help himself there. Now, let me run some numbers off for you about Eli Manning, by the way. Man, Florida James with the research. Eli Manning, since Odell Beckham came in the league, has completed 30% of his pass attempts with 20 or more air yards. There's one quarterback worse in that time period on such passes with 100 attempts. And that's Brock Osweiler. Yeah. Now, part of this is scheme, all that I'm about to point out now, should be noted, because McAdoo really changed it from that Kevin Gilbride down the field offense to try to make things shorter. But only 17% of Eli's pass attempts in that time period traveled more than 15 yards in the air. That's 29th in the league. We want to talk about the interceptions. Eli has 60 in that time. The only players with more are Blake Bortles and Phillip Rivers. Now, one thing about interceptions, by the way, is, of course, you know, it depends on how well the defensive players can catch. And sometimes guys skate because people drop a lot of their interceptions. It's also worth noting that sometimes guys' interception numbers might be a little higher because they got bad luck with dudes catching them. No, that's not what we got going here with Eli. Eli is actually second in dropped interceptions in that time period, behind only, again, Blake Bortles, who, holy smokes, he stinks. So Eli's throwing the ball to the other team. He's actually throwing it more to the other team than it appears that he is throwing it to the other team. And the only real weapon the Giants have had in the passing game worth discussing has been Odell Beckham. Odell Beckham since 2014 is 227 first downs, like catches for first downs. Next highest Giant in that time period, 95. By the way, the fourth highest Giant in that time period is Larry Donnell. Yeah, that tight end, they was all hype about that. I don't even think play for them no more. Most 20-yard receptions for the Giants since 2014. Odell Beckham has 30. Reuben Randall has 13. The next three guys on the list combined have 19. Yeah, so if I look at 4, 2, 3, 4, and 5 on this list of receivers with 20-yard receptions for the Giants, games as such, the next four guys have 32 combined behind Odell Beckham's 30. Right, it's undisputable that he's that dude. Everything he said about Eli Manning is correct. However, this makes me think of something that I have long thought about athletics that I don't think is discussed enough, but I believe is worth mentioning, which is we forget that we are dealing primarily with people in their 20s and maybe their early 30s when we talk about athletes. Right? That's who we're dealing with here. And people at those ages make bad decisions. It's just part of the game. They make bad decisions. Okay? We all agree upon that. Navigating the world as a visible professional athlete, you know what it really requires more than anything else? Wisdom. It requires wisdom. You don't get wise by 26, right? Like, part of what's interesting about LeBron is that LeBron gives off wisdom at a very, very early age. But LeBron wasn't wise at 25 or 26, right? Like, LeBron at 25 did the decision. That was not wise, right? You need a measure of wisdom to navigate through these things. And one thing that you figure out as you get older, and I believe I can pass on to you perhaps is what would qualify as a piece of wisdom. I'm only 38. I ain't got that much wisdom, but I feel like this qualifies as wisdom. Okay? For you younger folks that's listening, I really think you need to write this down. The fact that something is true is not a sufficient reason to say something, right? Like if somebody asks you why you said something and your answer is, but it's the truth. All right, you're going to need something secondary after that, okay? And I get it. What's so bad about saying something if it's true? You're absolutely right. You're right. In a vacuum, you are correct. But you pick up a little wisdom in the game and you figure out you don't say some things at some times in some places. And one thing you don't do, you just don't, right? You don't get out here saying things about your quarterback that sound like you're talking bad about him, even if they're true. You just don't do it. Now, maybe he said those things in Eli's face, but you just don't do it, right? Nobody would like to open up the newspaper and hear the things that they people think about them in that way. Nobody wants that, right? Like, that's not a wise thing to do. Like, I feel like when I look at athletes at this point in my life, especially cats that are in this age range, so I'm like, what, 12 years older than Odell Beckham? I got a brother who's 13 years older than me. I feel like in a lot of ways, I look at the things that those cats do through the same lens that I feel like my brother looks at the things that I do, right? And so I look at what he's doing and I'm like, man, I would have told him not to do that, right? Like that's the thought that I have in that one is I could see why somebody would think that's the groove. And I would be like, hey, little homie, let me come holler at you for a second and like lay a little bit of game on you. This is not the way for you to play things. Now, the Giants, I mean, Odell says he feels like it's galvanized the team. Odell went and talked in front of the team. And, you know, apparently they got it straight or whatever it is, all of that. But this is just not something that you would do. Like, here's what's funny about that to me, Gabe. Like, I like the idea of him going around the Giants media team and him doing it himself. But is this interview not exactly why the media team wants to be there for interviews?
Yeah, 100%. This is the opposite of the TEO. That's my quarterback.
Yes. He absolutely summed up those people's purposes for being there. And you know what? I think there might be a point where Odell flips on this. Like, I remember, like, with ESPN, people don't interview me that much, but it happens on occasion. And, you know, people would hit me up for interviews, and I'd be like, oh, yeah, just call me, whatever it is. Man, I got a little farther in the game, and I was like, yeah, let me have that PR lady on the line just in case they get over here and start tripping.
Oh, 100%.
You know, like sometimes you just don't feel like doing all of that. Sometimes you don't feel like the drama that's going to come from that. And if Eli Manning were saying the same things about Odell Beckham, I feel the same way. The thing is, though, quarterbacks are given this leadership mantle. And as a result of having the leadership mantle, we give them a little more rope on some of the things that they say in public. Like, that's just the nature of the hierarchy of football. That's what it is. Like, it would go over better in public if Eli Manning did that rather than vice versa. Now, the thing that seems to be interesting here about Beckham is Beckham seems to want to lead, right? Like, he seems to want to be a leader. Did you notice him, by the way, when Sterling Shepard was losing his mind on the sideline, that it was Odell Beckham trying to calm him down?
Yeah, he was like, man, I did that a couple of weeks ago and I got in big trouble.
Yeah.
Probably not a good idea for you to do that, but yeah. I'm going to go ahead and pat on your back anyways.
Yeah, no, like he's trying to be the leader. You can be the leader as a wide receiver within the wide receiver room, but it's hard to lead the whole team. Like the nature of that position makes it difficult for you to be the guy that leads the whole team. This is an interesting experiment if that's what he's going to try to do. And I don't blame him because he's the best player on the team. He's getting paid like a dude who should be leading the team. And by the way, their quarterback isn't good. So he like can lead, but at some point somebody gonna be like, hey, can you get somebody who not sorry to tell me that? Maybe I'll listen. You know? I'm just saying, this ain't the way to do it. That's all it comes down to for me and Odell. It's like, hey man, this is not the way to do it. I don't think you did anything wrong, but you really didn't do anything right. This is not the way that you want to play this. All this, however, to me is full-on confirmation. The Giants made a really bad draft pick this year. They did. And it's not because Saquon Barkley isn't good. Did you see that play where he jumped from like the 9-yard line into the end zone? I mean, it wasn't the 9.
He's an athletic dude, man.
Dude, man, I mean, that looked like something out of the Matrix, man. I was like, what are you doing? He is amazingly physically talented. He can do so many different things. They should have taken a quarterback. They had to take a quarterback. The clinging to Eli Manning that they have done is just ridiculous. They needed to get a new quarterback. They didn't do that. They would not be having these problems that they're having right now if they had just made a move and gotten a different quarterback. And if you need some proof that they should have gotten a different quarterback, it is possible that the best pass I saw thrown in that game against the Panthers was thrown by Odell Beckham. Hey guys, did you see the game on Saturday? Gabe, did you see the game on Saturday?
I caught the highlights.
Yeah, Texas beat Oklahoma. Texas beat Oklahoma. I would like to know, by the way, the last time Texas beat Oklahoma, they still went 5-7. But Texas beat Oklahoma. It made my life much better. It really did. Now you have to understand, it's not an easy life for me being a Texas fan. I don't have a particular affection for the head coach. There has been just about nothing to cheer about since the year 2009. I had to deal with all the things of the Charlie Strong era that didn't actually have to do with me, but people made to have to do with me. Lost to Kansas. There was a loss to Kansas. We did that. Now we're back in the top 10, baby. Texas is number 9 in the AP poll. Now, I need you to understand something about me. As I'm a realistic type fan, I'm not going to overestimate for you how good my team is or is not, because I don't feel like that is required for me to have an affection for a team. I don't need to lie about them. Like, I think that's a problem that people generally have in life, is they believe that just because you love somebody, you have to act like that person is better than who they are. Right. In fact, I believe that what you are saying when you do that is that you don't actually love them, because you have to put them in a position to justify the fact that you love them. And I don't do that. I don't do that with my people. I don't do that with my football team. No, sir. Do I think they're one of the 10 best teams in the country? No. They lost to Maryland. Like, that did happen. Right. They lost to Maryland. When a team fires its defensive coordinator after losing to you, they are telling you, in part, that this wasn't about you, right? Like, if you're really good and you give up 48 points, people don't get fired for it. They say, hey, that was a really good team. Instead, Oklahoma looked up at Mike Stoops and was like, you give up 48 points to them? Psh, beat the street. But he did make them quit, which, like, feels good, except for the fact that Mike Stoops quitting means that Mike Stoops doesn't work there anymore. And it was really good for everybody when Mike Stoops worked there. And by everybody, I mean opponents. It was great. That was, yeah, that was the thing. But nah, man, people keep, everybody wants to go to the is Texas back question. It is, you know, which goes from the longstanding is Miami back question. Texas won 10 games from 2001 to 2009 every season. 10 games every season. You ain't going to get back in 6 games. Like, that's not really how this thing works. You don't get back in one season. I have seen the one season Texas Wonder before. That ain't, no. That's not how it works. It don't matter if they back, man. They there. They there right now. Enjoy the fact that they are there right now. And try to ignore the fact that Kyler Murray put up 3 touchdowns in like 3 minutes to come back off a 21-point lead. Do you realize how different this whole segment would sound, Gabe, if they had lost that game after giving up to 21 points in the fourth quarter?
Or if Kyler Murray had decided to play for the A's instead of playing quarterback for Oklahoma.
Yeah, I still don't understand why in the world he's out here playing quarterback, to be honest, right? Like, he's so good. I get it. I guess he just wants to be a football star, right? Like, this is his last chance to be a football star. I guess that there's a certain charm and nobility, like, and there's a quaintness to it, I suppose. Everybody else in the country other than Oklahoma fans have to hope he's gone. He's so good. Like, his freshman year at Texas A&M, you saw the talent. I saw the talent, but I didn't see the football player, like, especially throwing. I just did not see it. Man, this dude is a cheat code at this point. He is absolutely 100% a cheat code. Aha, but they lost. But they lost. See, the thing about Texas-Oklahoma games, they typically play it at noon. So they play it at noon. You get like the good feeling of the victory, and then you still got your whole day. Like, if the weather's nice, the sun will be shining outside, and you still got it. Like, man, it just doesn't do much better than winning that game. And I'm just, you know, sitting around waiting for it all to fall apart.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bo, this first story comes from transportation.
Hi, this is Henry Grabar from Slate. Last week, the budget airline Primera Air abruptly shut down, leaving thousands of travelers stranded. The scene in Paris's Charles de Gaulle Airport was chaos, as hundreds of passengers scrambled to book new day-of tickets by phone. Primera had operated low-cost flights in Europe for years, but it became popular with Americans this year, thanks to flights between East Coast cities and European capitals as low as $99 one way. It seemed too good to be true, and it was. Primera seemed to be operating with a startup's mentality. Gain customers now, find profits later. One reason carriers like Primera and Norwegian are so cheap is that they don't have great backup plans when something goes wrong. They don't have interline agreements that allow them to shift passengers to other carriers, and they don't have big fleets of planes to pick up the slack. Primera's demise is an extreme example of a good travel maxim. When you buy with a budget airline, you get what you pay for.
All right, man. No disrespect, but if you bought a $99 one-way ticket to Europe, you deserve whatever happened to you. I mean, $99? Yeah. You can barely get a flight from New York to Philadelphia for $99. $99?
Yeah. I mean, are you familiar with Ryanair?
Yes.
So Ryanair's got a similar thing like Primera going on, except they don't make like trips over the Atlantic.
Yes.
It's kind of the same as Spirit Airlines.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Look, man, if you charge me $100 for a one-way flight, I can't take it over no water.
Yeah, because the thing about, I mean, I've done my fair share of budget airline travel, and the thing about it is, it's like, okay, well, you know, all these planes are the same, but then when you look inside the plane, it's like, this ain't the same.
This is not the same.
Do I feel safe in my seat? I don't know.
Right? Can I see the Carfax on this plane? Right? Like, wait, what can I do here? And so that's before we even get to the fact that people in the middle of their transit and they're like, "Yeah, bad news. We don't work here no more." Right? No. We haven't even gotten, by the way, to the people who actually work at the place.
Oh, man. And the other thing about this, too, is that these are people who traveled to these foreign countries on a budget.
Yes.
So now they're going to have to get back not on a budget.
Yes. Well, the other thing, too, that he did not mention that I think is actually maybe the funniest thing about this, and it's something that, like, I mean, it'll be kind of a duh moment, but it's still worth noting. Not only did they cancel the flights, they didn't have nobody taking calls. Like, people were getting on the phone to call up the airline and getting the doo-doo-doo. Right. So, like, your first instinct in a situation like that is to call. Guess that means I'm not getting my money back, huh?
Yeah, they were hearing airport music on the phone trying to get a hold of the airline.
Oh, the phone just ringing and ringing and ringing. Before they left the offices, did the people just put all the phones on hold? Because I feel like they didn't just cut the phones off, too, like all of them.
Yeah, I mean, you had to have gotten a voicemail or something. You would wonder who would be recording that voicemail. Sorry, guys, we went out of business. You're not going to be refunded for your flight.
Yeah.
You know, sorry again.
Well, how about this? Imagine being the one person that didn't get the memo that the company had closed down, and you just happen to go to work at the airport, and you're going to be working behind the counter, and you start strolling up, and you look, and you see that mass of people, but you don't see nobody else. Like, ooh, I'm going to go back home.
Yeah, you go to the gate, and you're kind of like, wait, what happened to the flight? I'm supposed to fly back home today. Or, like, a pilot. Now I got to find another airline to work for.
Hold on. If you can get to the gate, how you going to get to the gate with no boarding pass?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Like, you think, but I guess maybe if you printed it out the day before, but you can't get to the gate. Ooh, I'd be furious.
Trying to check in for your, well, I mean, then there's also, like, trying to check in for your flight and it not working. And be like, oh, well, I guess I'm going to have to show up early at the airport and check in.
Yes. Oh, man.
And then you got all your bags, everything.
Yikes. And it's a little, I imagine it raises some red flags when you try to buy this one-way ticket out of the country on, like, 3 hours notice.
Yeah, lesson learned.
Yeah, a lot of screening.
All right, story number two also comes from transportation.
My name is Charlotte Graham McClay, and I cover New Zealand for the New York Times. Border officials in most countries can look through your suitcase, but many travellers might feel like their digital devices are safe from prying eyes when they pass through customs. Well, New Zealand just implemented a law that says if you're asked to unlock your phone or laptop by border officials and you refuse, not only can officials confiscate your device, but they can also fine you $5,000 New Zealand dollars. That's about $3,300 US. In most countries, including the United States, border officials are asking an increasing number of travellers for their device passwords. So that's not new. But it's believed New Zealand is the first country in the world to impose a fine for refusing to fork over your passwords or your thumbprint. New Zealand Customs said this law change is meant to make it harder for them to just search anything they want. They have to believe your digital device holds evidence you've committed a crime. They also have to conduct initial searches of your device in flight mode. But privacy campaigners say that threshold is really vague, and there isn't any way to challenge an official who's demanding your password.
Okay, that's a little spooky, because this is the future. Just because they're doing it there, it doesn't mean they'll do it. They won't do it anywhere else. In fact, it means it's likely that they'll do it in other places. However, depending upon what kind of illegal business I might be into, if they're saying, we need to check your phone, or you can just give us $3,000, I'd give you $3,000, right?
Yeah, I mean, I just like played out this scenario in my mind of like the security person walking over to the person sees the security person coming over. It's like, oh, sir, I'm going to need your password. Nope. Oh, okay, cool. All right, see you later.
Well, my thing is, like, you need, they say there has to be like some reasonable suspicion that a crime has been committed. And by the way, gee, I wonder who they're going to be checking in customs when they come through for these things. I got the solution for you. You ready? What you need to do is you need to make it to where they ask for your thumbprint. You'll be like, okay, cool. Go ahead and give it to them. And then the first thing that's on your screen is like a collection of the most disgusting pornographic images that you can find.
I've seen enough. Okay.
Yep. Yep. Make them rethink. Make them rethink that. Make them decide if they want to see what's next.
The thing about it is, too, is like in airplane mode. So, I mean, that means that they can access all photos, notes, messages to like a certain extent.
You can keep out your email.
Yeah. Which is still, it's still quite a bit, though.
Yeah, yeah. No. Mr. Mose. No, that's right. That's what I'm saying. Like, you use the pictures to your advantage. Make them do some math on this. Yeah, put it in my permanent record. I ain't tripping.
All right. This last story comes from the art world.
Hello, my name is Amy B. Wang, and I'm a reporter for the Washington Post. So we had a really interesting story out of London last week at a Sotheby's auction where a painting called Girl with Red Balloon by Banksy was being sold. For those who don't know, Banksy is an anonymous British graffiti artist, and he's best known for these murals that are very provocative or make some kind of political statement. But the most important detail to know for the auction is that the painting itself was held inside a fairly elaborate gold frame. Now, if you watch video of what happened, you can see that the bidding starts, it keeps increasing, and finally it reaches an amount roughly equivalent to $1.4 million. People are incredibly excited. The auctioneer brings his hammer down, declares that the painting is sold, and everybody in the room bursts into applause. While people are still clapping, there is a beeping noise that starts. It's an alarm. And inside that elaborate gold frame, for people paying attention, the canvas itself has started scrolling downward and emerging on the other side in shreds. It takes a moment, but you can see people as they realize in real time what's happening. This painting that just sold for $1.4 million is self-destructing before their eyes. This, of course, immediately makes headlines all over the world. People want to know, was Banksy in the room? How did he pull this off? What does it mean? Is this painting now worthless? The next day, Banksy uploads a video to his Instagram that shows him secretly building the shredding mechanism into the frame a few years ago, and he admits that yes, it was, quote, in case it was ever put up for auction. So in a way, it is a classic Banksy protest against commercialism, but the greatest irony of all this is that the stunt generated so much buzz that even with the painting in shreds, experts are now saying it's worth even more money.
I don't care how much it's worth. If I pay $1.4 million for that, I'm going to need to talk to the manager. Like, this is still an open box. Right? Like, you don't know what I bought this for. I'm going to need some bread, baby. Like you want to take 50, you got to take at least 50% off. 50% of the thing seems to shred. You got to take at least 50% off.
Yeah, because I mean, now they're saying it's like, oh, it's worth more now, but worth more to who?
Right.
The person who bought it was expecting a certain piece of art,
right?
And what they're going to be getting is now a different kind of a piece of art.
Yep.
It's like, oh, are you going to have a centerpiece in your foyer or in your living room with just a pile of shredded paper on it now.
Yeah, nah, give me a discount on this. Now, I think I am interested in the actual like frame and all that stuff. Number one, when these people get this stuff, they don't take it out to frame and inspect it. Like, I feel like you should have been able to notice somehow that it was a shredder frame. I don't know. Like, this didn't go through no kind of x-ray machine or nothing like that. I don't know. Maybe I'm just misunderstanding, but I would have expected there to be some like level of process on that. Number two, somebody, Banksy, and I did some Googling on this after I saw this, that there are some theories that Banksy may be a collection of people. There's a theory. There's one guy that gets named. I think his name is Robin Gunningham or something, is widely believed to be Banksy because wherever Banksy has done his work, Gunningham has also lived. But there's also people who have done studies and tie the whereabouts of Banksy stuff to be in line with Massive Attack tours, the group Massive Attack. And so there are people who believe that the front man of Massive Attack is Banksy, but somebody related to him or whatever had to be in the room, because otherwise I don't see how you could set off that shredder otherwise to pull it off. Like, now I'm totally fascinated by what has happened, but I am still saying that if you don't get some of your money back on that, you got played.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bo. So we put out for an AMA this week because we know that you get all these this or that, that or this questions on Twitter. People trying to ask you random questions. So we gave the people a forum. Here's the first one from Troy in Pittsburgh.
What's up, Omani? It's Troy from Florida, currently living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I remember once upon a time on your radio show, you said you could make the argument that Pat White was a better college quarterback than Tim Tebow. As someone with a lot of friends who are unnecessarily Gator fans, what is this argument? Because I need any reason to make these dudes salty. Love the show. Keep doing what you're doing. Peace.
Oh, yeah. I mean, wow. I off the top of my head with Pat White, this will be interesting. Let us not forget, Pat White was 4-0 in bowl games as a quarterback. Let us not forget also that 2005 West Virginia team with Pat White as a freshman legitimized the entirety of the Big East by winning that Sugar Bowl in the Georgia Dome against UGA. Like, that was one of the big wins. With Tebow, what gets to be interesting is what we're really talking about with him is that 2007 season, because he had 20 touchdowns passing and 20 touchdowns rushing. The best player in the country that year, by the way, was Darren McFadden. Tebow gets a lot of credit for as being winner guy. That team lost 4 games that year. We give Tebow a lot of credit for the speech. The speech came after losing a home game to Ole Miss. I would also note, by the way, that one of the most disrespectful acts in the history of college football happened on Tim Tebow's watch. 2007, Jacksonville, Georgia, Florida. Georgia scored the touchdown and the whole team went out there and celebrated, and Florida was shook for the rest of the game and did not win. So, as you value the winner stuff and all of that, Pat White's got bona fides on that one. Pat White did it sooner in his career. Also, let's not forget that year with the Fiesta Bowl where they went in there and they smacked Oklahoma in 2007 after Rich Rodriguez had left and Bill Stinkin' Stewart was the coach. Right? So yeah, Pat White did it had Slayton on the squad, but they weren't playing with the teams like Tebow had with Florida. There was no Percy Harvin that was in place there. So yeah, Pat White, greatly underrated college football player. Greatly underrated.
All right, question number two comes from Christian in Denver.
Hey, Bomani, this is Christian. So I'm a Nuggets fan, and way back in like 2004, my dad gets me a signed basketball by Carmelo Anthony. And obviously we know that Carmelo is no longer a Nugget. He's been bouncing around, and I am no Carmelo loyalist. So my question is, do I need to keep carrying this thing around as a memento, or can I finally play with this basketball? Thanks, Bo.
Wow, you should be thinking about selling it, right? Right? Like, I mean, I imagine that could fetch something. Carmelo still matters. Why, you want to go play with it?
I loved this question.
I did not see that coming. What an end around. I mean, if you want to go play with it, that's fine. Damn, that's disrespectful to Melo. That's so disrespectful.
The thing about it is, too, it's like, I mean, sometimes you have this piece of memorabilia where it's like a football that was signed.
Yeah.
And it's like, all right, it's been X number of years and you can't even see the signatures on it anymore. So it doesn't hold any value. Then you can play with it. But like, this wasn't even that long ago.
Yeah, I just don't see how that's ever on the list of balls to play with. I just, wow, damn.
Oh, man. All right, this last one's from Karina.
Hey, Bomani, this is Karima calling from upstate New York. Just want to know, now that you've settled into New York life, where is your favorite go-to spot to eat when you just don't feel like cooking? All right, thanks. Bye.
The answer to that is seamless. One thing I ain't about to be telling y'all is where I hang out, and y'all might mess around and come. Yo, man, no. I've gotten a lot more paranoid about my surroundings, but yeah, I like Seamless, boy. Seamless in New York is a different animal. Like, and Miami was a good delivery city, and this is, like, I think the people who grow up in places like New York, they overestimate how much delivery there is everywhere else. Right? Because delivery works in New York because the city is vertical. So you have so many places that'll be willing to bring you food because they don't have to go very far in order to do it. That's not how it works in most places. Most places are more spread out. But here, dog. Man, listen, and I live in Harlem, man, I can get anybody to bring food to my house. The problem is, since I can't afford to get anybody to bring food to my house, I do just have people bring food to my house all the time. Like, it's not that I haven't been to the grocery store. I just haven't truly treated it like a grocery store. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you. Also, thanks to our sponsor, ZipRecruiter, and thanks to our guest, Henry Gabar of Slate. Check out his story on Primera Airlines just shutting down and not telling nobody beforehand. Thanks to Charlotte Graham McClay. She writes about New Zealand for the New York Times. Her story about the new flight security measures they're employing in New Zealand. And thanks to Amy B. Wang of The Washington Post, who told us about the Banksy story with him shredding millions of dollars right after somebody had spent it. Remember, subscribe to the podcast, ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, wherever you can get it. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think that you're a hater. Talk to you guys in a couple of days.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.